This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of September 21st, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Krieg DeVault. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. It's time again to check in with Pete Dunn, aka Pete the Planner, who, as you probably know, provides financial planning and money management advice through his services like Your Money Line and Hey Money. In his column for IBJ this week, he takes a different tack after several months of advice on how we can shore up our own finances and avoid the pitfalls of the pandemic. And in essence, this week, he is saying, now is the time for us good consumers to come to the aid of the economy. And specifically, we need to devote our available resources to restaurants. They desperately need our patronage. And it won't be too long before we see another big wave of restaurant closures. Now, given all we have been through over the last 6 months, I understand if you're thinking to yourself, why exactly is this my problem? Well, in the first segment of the podcast today, Pete is going to tell you why. In the second segment, I'm going to take this opportunity to ask him a bunch of questions that have been simmering in my head over the last several months. Like, what's the rest of the year going to be like? Do I need to prepare my portfolio for the outcome of the election, whatever that is? Is this the right time for me to pay off my mortgage? And can I count on Social Security being there for me when I retire, which isn't terribly far away? So without further ado, let's get to it. Here's our conversation. It is my pleasure to welcome back to the IBJ Podcast Virtual Studio, Pete the Planner. Thanks for making time today.
It is my pleasure. It's always good to be with you, Mason.
Real quick, how is everything?
Everything's good. You know, I've turned early in the pandemic, I turned my focus to eating as much as I can. And I'm at this stage of the pandemic, I am ridding myself of that food and making it so then we go back into public, none of my suits fit because I'm in such good shape. That's my current thing.
Yeah, I'm walking the dog like twice a day now. So
nice.
By the way, that does nothing to eliminate your beer belly. Okay, I got a lot of questions I want to ask today about a lot of different things. Let's get to it. First up, I want to ask you about your column that you've written for the latest issue of IBJ and what I see as some inconsistency in the advice that you are giving us. Now, a recollection of our past conversations is that you want us to get our discretionary spending under control. Cut the fat, cut it to the bone. Was I hearing that correctly?
That at one point in time, in this moment we're in, was correct. I did want the average person to cut the fat and get stable, yes.
Now, in your latest column, you present a very passionate plea for getting out and spending as much money as you're comfortable at local restaurants. Obviously, while social distancing, either through outside dining or carryout or delivery. Why is that?
I think we've transitioned to a different phase where a lot of people have reached stability or a level of stability they're comfortable with. And there are some people that were stable the whole time, but they were just hunkering down out of pragmatism, right? But Mason, we've entered this time where our favorite places, the places where we celebrate big moments, the places where we just get away from the house and have a meal, they're going to go start going out of business hand over fist starting in November. If people don't step up who are stable and start to invest, if you will, in the future of those businesses once this whole garbage time is over.
Do you have special knowledge of this, or is this just your gut feeling?
I've had some conversations with several independently owned restaurants. Times are tough, man. If you are in Marion County, you are asked to make it work on 50% capacity. If you know anything about the restaurant business, what you know is that the margins are razor thin at 100% capacity. And in the column and now, I'm not blaming any government official for the capacity rules. I mean, I'll let someone else sort that out. All I know is for people who have discretionary income, don't relinquish your opportunity to help these people because we're so mad arguing at what government official is right or wrong. Get out there and support them. I just know this. A lot of restaurant owners are really concerned about November, December for a couple different reasons. Number one, the outdoor dine-in season in Indiana goes away. Number two, they make most of their money, like a lot of retailers, at the end of the year with what they like to call ladies who lunch at the holidays. The holiday gatherings during the day or at night. And Mason, even if those are allowed to happen, they just need to get to that moment. And there is actual very real fear that they will not get to that moment in early December.
That is a terrific analysis. I had forgotten about kind of the weird way that the business changes around the holidays. And I'll just add parenthetically, I was working on some restaurant stories yesterday and spoke with a couple of Broad Ripple restaurateurs. One of them said that his sales were down 30% compared to last year. Another who had opened recently said that their sales were 30% of what they expected, anywhere between 30 and 70% less than either what you expected or that you had proven to show. It's pretty terrible.
It is. And there's an additional responsibility that the people of Indianapolis have adopted voluntarily or otherwise, is that we are a hospitality center. We offer nice amenities to people who want to come to our city and visit it and leave their money here. And it is much harder for the good people of Visit Indy and the city at large to sell us as a destination for gatherings when all the cool restaurants are gone. And I mean that. I think what's tough in the last few weeks is we've lost some really iconic restaurants in downtown Indianapolis, neo-iconic restaurants in downtown Indy. It's not like it's St. Elmo's, but you know, Rook and Black Market, very popular followings. I mean, I've had some really special meals there myself, and it's not that the food wasn't good. It's just the economics stopped working. And again, my column was the weirdest column I've ever written in over a decade of writing a newspaper column this week, because I'm putting it out there. I'm telling people what to do. I'm saying go out to eat or your favorite place is going away. And I firmly believe that.
You know, what it sounded to me like it was, and maybe I'm really reaching here, is that you're saying that while the essence of financial planning is to make sure that you and your family are stable and have the resources to be comfortable, spending money at restaurants right now is in service to a greater good.
100%. And if I had the wherewithal to use the phrase greater good at the hour of mourning of which I penned that column, I would have done it. But that's exactly right. I think people think the end all be all of financial planning is financial security and stacking it, as the kids say, to have as much money as you can in the end. I don't subscribe to that idea. I think it's to be able to live the life you want to live in a community that you want to live in. And so if the restaurants that I like to enjoy as part of my lifestyle are gone, no matter how much money I have in the bank, Mason, my life's not the same. And I know the criticism those comments will take. And I guess I finally just stopped sitting on this column idea for the last several months and put it out there because I just don't care anymore, because I think, I mean, this is a siren. I think the restaurant business is in really, really, really big trouble.
And we forget maybe that even though these businesses have relatively small footprints, I mean, they can employ a lot of people. I mean, dozens and dozens of people.
I like to think about the airline issue that's going on right now. And late last week, the president or the White House, I should say, welcomed the airline industry to the White House to have some discussions about an extension of support for those industries. Well, as it stands, on October 1st, tens of thousands of airline workers are going to be laid off because the stimulus program ends on September 30th. So Mason, I'm saying this to you, that every time a restaurant closes, it has a ripple effect for those workers, the vendors, the suppliers. It's not one business. It's the wine distributors, and it's everyone involved. So, and by the way, this isn't just some self-serving moment where I want to preserve the wine distributors, although sometimes it feels like it. But that's the weird cruelty of this moment. There's a liquor store, I think I've talked to you about this, not far from my house, that has record day after record day since the middle of March. They've been open for just over a year, and they cannot believe how good they have it financially. And I'm sure there's some socioeconomic issues and even anthropological issues of why that is. However, that's the cruel uncertainty of small business today.
And anecdotally, a good buddy of mine, you know, who's got three girls at home and, you know, lives here. And well, I'm not a Meridian Castler, but he is. You know, he was one of the first people I knew that lost his job, and he works for a food distributor.
Yeah, that's wild because of how our food habits have changed. Those places that distribute foods to restaurants as opposed to places that distribute foods to grocery stores, that determines the fate of those particular organizations. That's tough to hear.
Now, you suggest allocating the money in particular ways, if you have the money to spend on restaurants. Should we try to spread it around and frequent as many restaurants as we can, or should we try to focus?
I think focus makes more sense. And this is just my opinion, right? A lot of times I try to give an informed opinion, and I don't know where this one lines up other than this just happens to be my opinion. I think choosing three restaurants or so and focusing your efforts there makes a lot more sense. And just assume that the natural taste differences of your neighbors will account for the other restaurants that you're not visiting. But Mason, I think it's also about being able to care on a deep level, a relational level for people. If I have three restaurants I'm trying to support, I likely know the manager's name. I likely know the owner's name. They know my name, and it means more to me to go spend those dollars. If I'm going to the like local whatever that I don't care that much about, I just read a dumb article about spreading your money around, then it's tougher to stay committed to the cause. So I'm just doing it from a practical standpoint, is if there's three restaurants that you really care about and you know people's names and you know the servers' names and you know their kids' names because you talk to them when they come to your table, then that's the way to go.
Now, how do I know that I have the wherewithal to get out and support these restaurants? Is there a formula I can use?
Well, this is a three-hour conversation now. There are 10 factors to financial stability, and I'm not going to go through them, but I will tell you there are 10. The one we all think about is how many months of emergency reserves do you have on hand? So as a base level, if you have 3 months worth of emergency reserves, you do have the financial wherewithal to go out and support three restaurants on a very regular basis to try to keep them open. If you have significantly less than 3 months expenses, you may need to focus on your own stability first.
Is there a suggested time frame? Should I try to space this out over the rest of the year, or should I just turn the fire hose on?
I say you turn the fire hose on. Here's the other weird part that I didn't mention. The gift card conversation gets real nuanced real fast.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you start buying gift cards of places that you're afraid they're going to go out of business, one, you have to be comfortable with the idea that they could go out of business and you don't get anything in return other than the good feeling that you tried to help them. The other side to this too is it goes back to the holiday season. Where do restaurants make a ton of money? Gift card sales at the holidays, that they can realize that money now, and they can even account for the fact that weirdos like me might occasionally misplace that gift card and never use it. Therefore, they just made a profit without ever dealing a service on the other side. So that's scary too. I think people are going to be apprehensive to buy gift cards from local restaurants as the holiday season approaches.
You also suggest that we try to avoid third-party delivery services. Why is that?
Because they take their share. If the margins are razor thin for the restaurant industry, and 30% of the pay that I pay for a restaurant bill to have it delivered to my front door goes to a third party, then that thins out the margins even more for those restaurants. They don't only get delivery fees and a tip, those third party services, they also get a portion of the take, which is a problem. So the restaurateurs that I'm friendly with definitely don't like those services, that you kind of feel bullied into them. And as someone who have used those services quite a bit over the years when convenient, I've personally decided to just get in my car and drive and pick up my food and quit being lazy.
You know, honestly, sometimes that is the only reason I have to leave the house. I mean, my wife and I fight over who gets to pick up the food.
We are such a convenience society. You and I swear we've talked about this before. We are such a convenience-based society. Everything we do is around convenience. A lot of the businesses, like these third-party delivery apps, play into this idea of wanting convenience. To rebuild an economy that's broken, you have to take some of that convenience back out and have more relational transactions. That's what I think will help us going forward.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, and then we'll be back with more Pete the Planner. This is the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ Podcast is brought to you by Krieg DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Krieg DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Krieg DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.kriegdevault.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. I have a raft of questions now for Pete the Planner about our short and long-term prospects.
All right, lace up your track shoes. I've got an extended lightning round for you. I've got questions of my own, questions that I've received from my few acquaintances. And let's try to maybe 90, 120 seconds, though occasionally, you know, if it's too much, just let me know. Oh, first question that I actually got from a group called Midtown Parents that I belong to. Very quickly, how do I get started setting up a budget? I mean, a lot of our conversations have sort of assumed that we've done a budget already. How do you get started?
I love this question because it's honest. You know, it's like, oh yeah, we budget. No, it's an honest question. Here's what you do. You go to your bank statement and you just classify the last 30 days of spending into categories. And you just take a look and you're just like, okay, well, these are my habits. These are my habits. You know, I want this habit to change. So then what you do is you subtract 10% from that amount. So I'm going to just use big round numbers. No one freak out. Let's say I spend $500 a month at the grocery store. I would say, well, I'd like to spend $450. I take four trips a month. That means I need to spend $112.50 per trip. And so that's how you do it. That's how you change habits. We call them price targets, where you see a category that you're struggling with, reduce it by 10% in 1 month, see if you can hit that target. And the way you really hit that target, Mason, is that you look at the frequency of which you spend in that category. It's not about the dollars. It's about saying, I go four times a month, so I need to divide my price target by four. And that's how you set the price target.
Wow, beautiful. I assume, you know, also if you're wily enough on the internet, that there are some services there that might help you, or should you be wary of that?
It's not that by being wary of it, other than I think to do this manually, to remove the convenience from the situation is what you need to do. Look, man, I've been doing helping people budget for 20 years. I like people to use a spreadsheet or a piece of paper because it forces you to dig into your data.
Next topic. We went from talking about a V-shaped recovery to a swoosh-shaped recovery. And now, just in the last week, I have started hearing references to the K-shaped recovery. What is that? And how does that affect me?
I buy into the K-shape. Yeah. I'm telling you, I'm all in on the K-shape. It is this idea that a portion of the economy in particular industries will recover robustly. And another portion of industries, because they can't do business as normal, or as usual, they will head the other direction. So think of a K, there's an upward leg and a downward leg. You don't want to be on the downward leg of a K recovery. And I think both the economy at large will go through this. And I think what's even more disconcerting, because people are part of an economy, that people's general personal finances will also go into a K-shaped recovery, which means we have to use the phrase I hate to use the most, the rich will get richer. The wealth gap will grow.
Is the restaurant industry on the downward part of the K?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, top end of that are things like the grocery business, home improvement, landscapers. On the downward, plexiglass manufacturers. On the downward leg, you got things like restaurant and travel, even personal services like grooming. I know we reserve grooming for dogs, but you know what I mean? Personal grooming.
Sure. Moving on. Do I need to do anything with my investments or finances to either take advantage of this election or to protect myself from this election?
I like this question because the best way to answer it is to say, well, what is the money for? And the answer is always, well, it's for the future. But when? Is it for 25 years from now? Because if it's 25 years from now, a long-term approach says probably just leave it alone. This is my opinion. I don't believe that people should always feel compelled to make money in down markets, right? I don't think if you think something bad is coming, that you need to position yourself to take advantage of the bad times. And there's a couple of reasons. Number one, that's really risky. Number two is, Mason, let's say you think the election and the weeks surrounding the election are going to get hairy. And by the way, if you feel that way, you are one of 100% of Americans who feel that way. So let's say you feel that way. And so you say, all right, I'm going to get out of my investments and let that thing cool out. You may be right of when to get out, right? You may be right, but you will never be right as to when to get back in. And that's the reason you probably should just leave it alone. This is not specific investment advice. Consult your financial advisor. But I'm a buy and hold guy for my long-term goals. And I will also say that if you have invested money that is for short-term goals, why do you have invested money for short-term goals? This is an incredibly volatile market. You probably should not have that.
Related question, what is the rest of the year going to be like? Last time we spoke, I think you said something to the effect of, next time we speak, I'll know what the rest of the year is like. I'll give you a pass if that's true, but do you have a feeling, or are there a couple of likely scenarios?
All right. So my goal is never to be pessimistic nor optimistic. It's to be realistic. I think starting in late October, the rest of the year as it relates to the economy, not the market, the economy is going to be a slaughterhouse. I think it's going to be absolutely brutal. And the reason revolves around the eviction moratorium that President Trump signed into law, the executive order. And here's why.
Yeah. And this was just like 2 weeks ago.
Yes. So basically, you cannot be evicted for financial reasons right now, as long as you go to the CDC website and you fill out a declaration and hand it to your landlord and say, look, the COVID-19 has affected my finances. I certify this. I'm verifying this. So you can't be kicked out for that. So what that essentially does is this executive action says, okay, we are backing the renter at the cost of the financial life of the landlord, because the landlord still has to pay the mortgage. The landlord still has to deal with their financial obligations, but that all switches on December 31st at midnight, where then it goes back to the renter, because not only is your rent due for January, all the back rent is due. And if you don't pay it, you can be kicked out. I think there will be mass eviction in January, unless there's either an extension or there's some degree of stimulus that adds an economic component to that moratorium. As it stands now, it just says, landlords, your problem until December 31st. January 1st, renters, your problem. So I'm not saying it does nothing. It does something, but it delays the inevitable of the market working itself out.
What does that have to do with October through? You're expecting some problems.
Well, yeah. I think one of the major issues, if it does not get solved in the next week, is going to end up being the airline shutdown, like the airline layoffs, I should say, October 1st. And I think if that happens, and then that takes us into the period of election where some people think we may have some uncertainty around knowing who the president is, and whatever, think what you want there, not for me to say. I think that anxiety will stoke a lot of economic uncertainty, and it will stall out whatever recovery has happened. And I think that bleeds into the end of the year. That sounds really pessimistic. That's just the way I see it. And I hate to say this, because I never say this. I've been right since March of what's going to happen to the economy. And I'm sticking with my gut here. I think it's going to get nasty.
Well, let's back up for a second. So you are predicting a slaughterhouse.
Not in the market, necessarily. In the economy.
So I should still be a buy and hold guy, though.
Well, that's the market.
Yeah.
I think when I talk about the economy, I'm talking about unemployment rates. I'm talking about GDP growth/contraction. I'm talking about housing, not from a terms of market value of homes, but who is going to be evicted come January. That's what I'm talking about. The market will have some uncertainty too, but the fact of the matter is the Fed is propping up the stock market so much with keeping rates artificially low, with pumping money into the market via bond purchases. I think I'm much more worried about the economy than I'm ever worried about the stock market. I think 12 months from now, the stock market's completely fine. No matter what it does over the next 12 months, the economy, I'm still not so sure.
Here's one that might end up being too long a conversation. If so, just tell me. I got some other stuff. But if everything goes according to plan, best case scenario, I will be able to retire in 15 years. Can I count on Social Security being there in 15 years? Is it fair? Is it a fair assumption that I can count on that money being there?
I'm going to answer this question, but in a very strange way, which is a tradition around here. I think you can count on it, but not when you think you're going to get it. I think the date of which you're able to receive it will move back. And I also think it will be a lesser amount. I happen to be 42 years old. I feel less certain about my ability to get it at all. And I think anyone who has a 2 in front of their age has zero chance whatsoever to get Social Security in its current form.
Wow.
Yeah, I told you, like, this is the, we're entering the part of the conversation that gets to macabre at best, right? It's ugly.
I was listening to your podcast, Beat the Planner podcast,
this week. Two listeners now, you and my mom. Thank you.
Sure. We listened to it together, actually.
Oh, good.
We actually Zoom call it. And there was an interesting question about deciding to pay off your mortgage in full. This person's financial situation is different from probably most people. But I will say that it's a question that I have asked myself. We don't have a whole lot of money left on our mortgage. And sometimes I think to myself, man, if we just pay this off, we're going to get rid of that $1,000 a month. And isn't that a smart play in a very financially precarious time?
Potentially, right? So here's how I look at this situation. Number one, the interest you pay on your mortgage, most people, it's a really low rate compared to the money you should be able to gain in investment returns on the money you have invested. So if you're paying 2.75% on a mortgage, but you're getting an 8% return on your money, then you wouldn't want to take the money you're getting an 8% rate of return on and pay off the mortgage. The leverage just doesn't work there. The other side of this, though, too, is people often do this and they'll say, well, I could always borrow against the mortgage, once I've got it paid off. But I find that to be, home equity is incredibly illiquid and it doesn't actually grow, right? So if you've got 100% equity in your home, there's no rate of return associated with the amount of equity you have. Sure, the home value can go up, but the home value is going to go up whether you have equity in it or not. And it's still rather illiquid. So I like paying a mortgage systematically over time. And I hate taking an actual asset and liquidating the asset to pay off a mortgage. Like sometimes people at 59 and a half, they get access to their 401k money and they just take a big chunk of it and pay off the rest of their mortgage so they feel better. That makes me nauseous because it's generally a really bad idea.
Moving on. I have made some phenomenally bad decisions when investing over the years. The highlight probably was going big in a NASDAQ index fund at the very end of 1999. Which you might recall was the end of the dot-com boom. And I sat on that for years because I was like, this is going to go back up at some time. Finally, I had to get rid of it. But I've got some other bad investments. And my question is, should I sit on it and wait for it to go up or just take my lumps and cash out?
Yeah, just, man, that's a real big depends answer there. I think sometimes amateur individual investors, they get ideas. They're like, you know what? I got a hunch here and I'm going to act on this hunch. And this hunch is going to take me to the promised land. And when it doesn't, then there's this just, escalation of risk as you let it go on. If you just keep it going, but for no good reason, with no analyst telling you that it makes sense, it ends up being a bad idea. I happen to think that's why a lot of individual investors get out in front of their skis is because they try to outsmart the market. Now, to your point, you were using a NASDAQ index fund, which is not exactly the most complex thing in the world. But my guess is the question you're asking is not about broad index funds. It's probably about things that are a little cuter than that are harder to guess. So I don't know, maybe not the most succinct answer, but I'll tell you, it does talk about the importance of advice from a financial expert, not someone like me, but an actual investment advisor.
Let me ask you, and for the folks that are worried about their jobs, if you, Pete Dunn, had to switch careers right now, if you developed an ailment that kept you from giving financial advice, or the Pete the Planner Board of Directors gave you the boot, where would you start looking for a new industry?
Man, what a great question. Oh, what, I've been on your podcast like 10 times. Best question you've ever asked me.
Oh, thank you.
Of course, I'm saying that just so I can stall and think of it.
I can see the wheels turning.
Wow. I'd still go sort of like computer development, like being able to program and to work, to code, that whole thing. I still think it just has limitless possibilities to be able to build digital infrastructure for companies that just need people that speak that language. Now, I have no interest in that whatsoever, nor do I have the brain or the attention to detail that could pull that off. But if you're asking me from a pure financial perspective as to what I would do that even though I don't hold the skill set. The question's different. It's like, well, what would you do if you could do anything? That's a different question, which I don't think you particularly care the answer for.
Yeah, but in terms of, if you know, here I am, I'm 40 or I'm 50, and suddenly, you know, my industry is in tatters, which, you know, is a real possibility for me. Where would I look?
Yeah, I'd go to one of those coding academies that can get it done in 6-9 months. You teach you, you know, a particular computer language, programming language, and then get you working at a moderately salaried job.
Well, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
It's fun. Stay safe, man.
My thanks again to Pete Dunn. Before you get on with the rest of your week, I wanted to point out a few stories in the latest print edition of IBJ. Susan Orr takes stock of the economic forces gathering to batter small businesses this fall. The pressure is intensifying as the pandemic drags on and firms burn through the last of the government assistance that eased the financial pain earlier this year. And in particular, as we just discussed with Pete Dunn, the restaurant scene is expected to undergo a devastating shakeout. Also in this week's issue, Greg Andrews examines how Simon Property Group is breaking the mold in retail real estate by buying up bankrupt brands such as Brooks Brothers and JCPenney. And of particular note is how the enigmatic and press-adverse CEO David Simon is handling the national spotlight. And Mickey Shuey takes us backstage at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Museum, where there are hundreds of vehicles that never go on display. As the facility looks to upgrade its collection, dozens of those cars are going on the auction block. Again, you can see these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ and online, of course, at IBJ.com. I will say that it is a lot easier to access all of IBJ's award-winning business content if you have a subscription. It works out to about $2 per week, which honestly is pretty good for the amount of information you get that can help you make important decisions in these next few months. Just go to IBJ.com, click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.